Every Word, a podcast of the Concordia Bible Institute, housed on the beautiful campus of Concordia University, Wisconsin. This is your opportunity to read, mark, learn, and inwardly digest the sacred scriptures with me, Dr. Brian Gurman, assistant professor of theology here at the university and the current director of the Concordia Bible Institute. Today, however, we have a special guest joining me in the podcast room, Dr. Dan Pavla, not only a colleague of mine, but also a former professor of mine back in the day. Professor of theology here. Very excited to hear from him today about seven biblical themes. Now, I'm just struck here right off the bat here. The Bible, of course, is a pretty large book. It's standard English translation. Maybe I happen to have the Lutheran Study Bible in front of me. The thing's probably over 2,000 pages. And you have lots of different material in there, legal stuff, narrative, all these. But at the same time, when all said and done, there are some themes that we can gather. So if you wouldn't mind, Dr. Pavla, introduce some of these themes and what we'd be talking about today. That'd be great.
All right. Well, thanks, Dr. Gurman. It really is a pleasure to be here and to be with you, kind listeners. I teach, as Dr. Gurman does, a survey of the Bible class here at Concordia and also as a parish pastor, and started to realize over years that people need a comprehensive, cohesive look at the Bible. Wonderful to have many, many, many small pieces of information and ideas, but are there things, repeated actions that go across from Genesis to Revelation, not predictably in every chapter or necessarily even every book? And I've developed a number of these, usually speak of seven of them. It's a good biblical number. So the first one, I think, begins really, though, naturally in Genesis 1. But to preface it, I'll just say I grew up on a dairy farm, and my dad was a great mechanic. And when Dad retired from the farming, he was still on the farm. And what do I do with Dad? I was the only son, and so Dad and I just worked together. That's everything we knew. We bought a 1917 Model T Ford for $250. It was a piece of junk, and we restored it. It took us 4 years, and we enjoyed it so much that we then bought a 1930 Model A Ford, another piece of junk. It took us 4 more years to restore that. So we spent 8 years restoring these two old Fords, which it doesn't take 8 years if you would just get out the parts catalog. And if money were no object, and money definitely was an object for us, you just ordered up all the parts. Right. You'd have every part we restored, you'd have it perfect, new, by the end of the week.
Sure.
And you'd have instant perfection, but we were seeking patient relationship. And that's, I think, the first biblical theme. You look at Genesis 1, and we have an instant perfection creation and an instant perfection God. When God says, let there be light, there's light. Let there be... all of creation is instant, perfect, and with that expectation, I think we step into the Bible. And it's not just in Genesis. When Jesus touches the leper and says, be clean, he is instantly, perfectly clean. You know, when Jesus says to Lazarus, come forth, he is instantly at the door of the tomb, walking out, he's well. We have an instant perfection God. In our prayers, I know we want an instant perfection God. I want it right now, God. I know you can do it. But God often puts an arm around our shoulders and says, I'm going for patient relationship. I'm going to stay with you, Adam and Eve, outside the garden. I'm going to be with Noah in the patient relationship of decades of building that ark. That God could have just said, let there be ark, but instead patiently in relationship with Noah. And he does the same thing with us over and over again. And I think this is one of the most basic themes that goes across the Bible. I seek an instant perfection. God says, we're in relationship, Dan.
I had a number of stories come to mind as you were describing that, and that is the times in the Bible where God could certainly just, for example, tear down Jericho, and yet he's got a seven-day plan, you know, and things like that. Or why don't we just, you know, I'm trying to think of maybe the Mount Sinai, come back on the third day or something like that.
Absolutely.
Why not just right away?
Get it done.
And that's the sort of mentality we have
absolutely
in our prayers, in our lives, and things like that. But at the same time, he has this other patient relationship in mind for our good, doesn't he?
A down-spirited Elijah, 1 Kings 19, he could have just grabbed him by the scruff of the neck, said, get back in the game, so to speak.
Right.
I got a job for you.
Right.
He endures with him for the 40 days. Yeah. He endures with Israel for 40 years. Patient relationship. So it's a nice contrast, and many of our themes have that both and kind of a tension-filled dualism. This is the first one.
Then speaking of that dualism, as you just referenced there, it kind of leads quite naturally into this second theme here I see on your list. It's not the first, but the second that counts.
Right.
What do you mean by that?
Well, first, a disclaimer. There's only two children in our family, and I'm second.
Oh, okay.
So you got to know that I love this theme because, no offense to my sister, but it's not the first child in the family. It's the second that counts.
Which one
are you?
I'm number two.
Hey, all right.
I
know.
Two out of five.
Obviously, it's the second that counts. Yeah, no.
That's great.
Biblically, isn't it just something that God seems to prefer? He uses it again and again.
He does.
It's not the first. Oh, think of the possibilities. It's not Esau, but Jacob I have loved, and that is probably the clearest one where the secondborn Esau, Jacob the younger, is the one who is chosen, preferred by God from within the womb on. It's not the first king of Israel, Saul. It's the second, David, who overcomes all. It's not David and Bathsheba's first child. He dies. But it's their second child, Solomon, who is the wisest king that ever lives. Mm. It's not the tabernacle, it's the temple as a place, a place of worship. It's not one temple, it's a second. And ultimately, it's not temple at all, but a body of Christ who is torn down and rebuilt as the ultimate temple. And I think the biggest example on this one is it's not the first Adam, but the second. And I think it's that persistence of God to say, I'm going to stay with the original, though it's failed, been destroyed, trampled on by us. And while we would expect God to say, all right, that's it, we're done. Adam, what a mistake. I'm going to save you people, but I'm having nothing to do with this failure. He persists and says, it'll be a new Adam. It'll be a different temple. You know, it'll be a new Eden. Think of the images that Revelation 21, 22 have of heaven as, in essence, most everybody agrees, carrying a Eden-like imagery to us. The river, the trees of life, exactly.
Sure.
You know, wouldn't you think, given the horrific event of the fall into sin, God would say, we're wiping that out. We're having nothing to do with that. But instead he says, the second Eden is where we're going to be.
Yeah.
So I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there's no longer any sea. Now, this isn't an absolute. It doesn't mean that everything has a beginning and then a mere beginning and then a second. As I always say, don't take this into marriage. Look at your first spouse and say, well, you're just a warm-up. You know, we're going to get to the real event later. That doesn't work. And it's not that all things need a second. There isn't a second sacrifice of Christ. He is the ultimate in his one and only sacrifice. But, you know, as just a general biblical concept, you kind of, when you see a first, you hold in your breath and saying, I bet there's going to be a second.
Yeah.
And there often is.
Yeah, and it says a lot about the character of God, too, doesn't it?
Yeah.
When things don't go quite well, maybe in our mind, I'll just wipe the hard drive clean and do something else. But no, maybe it kind of goes back to the patient relationship thing, too, where I want to work through that. I've got a second in mind. It'll be even better, a second Adam.
Oh yeah,
at the par excellence, so to speak, at the top of all of that. So it does pop up quite a bit. I was thinking also of Ephraim over Manasseh. I think at the end of Genesis, you know, just another one where it should be the firstborn, but it's not, and things like that. And it kind of in God's infinite wisdom to work these ways.
And it gives you hope. I remember doing this once with a large number of teachers who are in their first year of teaching. I mean, this really is a great principle to say to them. You know what? That first class might not be the be-all and end-all of teaching. It's not the first. It's the second that'll count. Now, you maybe don't want to stretch that over 30 years. You know, I keep waiting for one good class. But, you know, I think there's a measure of patience.
I got to say, you mentioned this earlier just today, actually, that I'm in my second year now here at Concordia. And so far, I can say it's not the first, but the second.
Right. It's better, isn't it?
It is a little bit better.
It is
better.
It is better. It really is.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so, I think many folks in all kinds of jobs and lines have seen that. Yeah, it's better. I mean, in just married life, you know, that first apartment, not good.
Right.
You know, it's gotten better.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, I like all this emphasis on the second, and that certainly is a nice segue, I would say, also to this next one on your list here. This third theme that you have there reads, one stands in the place of us all. So that sounds fascinating.
Well, it, I explain this with a true story. When I was in fourth grade, a kid named Ross hit me in the head with a rock. I didn't deserve it. We're, you know, just your classic picture, if you would, fourth graders on the playground, recess, you know, you had to lunch and recess, the best hour of the entire day. And out there, and he hit me right there. I could still feel it in the back of the head with a rock. I didn't deserve it. Now, what happens when one fourth grader out there on the recess gets hit with a head with a rock? You yell, you know. Now, there's always a teacher out there, and they never ever see the rock thrower. No, you know, no. they maybe see the ricochet, but and hear the kid yell. But so the teacher will always ask, "Who threw the rock?" No fourth grade rock thrower has ever volunteered their guilt, and so and again, this is a true story. So what happens to all 30 of us? Do we get to keep on having recess? No way, life. We all go inside. And in this story, and true again, it wasn't put your heads down on the desk. I mean, that would have been maybe okay. I would have taken a nap. But we had to do math. And I'm really not a big fan of math. And you know how you used to have to do the odd or the even? I remember we had to do all the problems. Mm. Now, how did we as a class feel about Ross, the rock thrower? We hated him,
That's
all because of you, you know. Yeah. Da, da, da. Okay, now that's true. Fast forward, just imagine, 8 years later, what if Ross, now a senior in high school, became a champion shot putter on the track team? I like the rock image there. And he goes to state for the very first time, and nobody in our little town has ever gone to state. Well, if he did that, then I would say probably on the Wednesday before he goes, at 2:30, we're going to have a pep rally. And everybody in the high school gets to get out and go to the pep rally, which means we get out of math class.
Yeah.
And I mean, not just fourth grade math. We get out of, like, calculus or something. How do we feel about Ross now? Fantastic.
Nice
Ross. We love Ross. And I think this is a wonderful biblical principle. At first, we hate it. This is not fair.
Right,
in Adam's
right.
fall, we are all falling. We're inheritors of this sin. I mean, there's not one of us that doesn't say, I could have held out longer than those two did in the garden. I don't know how fast they fell, but I could have hung in there. Why should I get saddled with this? And yet, the blessed other side is when the second Adam comes and takes the role of Adam and beyond failure with perfection, and a perfection not that's an impossible model for us to follow, which we couldn't, but a perfection that then is just freely deposited in our account, stands in place of us all. Now we think this is the greatest idea at all. We're not quibbling anymore about is it fair, is it just. We just embrace it. Yeah. And one in place of us all. I mean, you see other ones. The prophet, priest, king, trinity of the Old Testament images certainly depends on that same idea.
Sure.
We need one guy to go behind the curtain into the Holy of Holies, a place so frightening that we're going to put a bell on you and a rope on your ankle in case you are not found worthy.
Right.
I'm not volunteering for that job. I'd be very glad for somebody else to be the priest to go behind there and do that.
Sure,
you know,
so
one in place of us all, a classic biblical theme, and again, at first may be viewed with some, why? That doesn't sound fair. But when you look at the consequences, either the danger or the benefits that it brings, ultimately the benefits in Christ, we're all saying, God, thank you, wonderful. I'm glad to be just the recipient of one in place of us all.
Yeah, that's well said. I remember, and when you mentioned prophet, priest, king especially, there are lots of narratives where I'm thinking, boy, you get one bad king and then a lot of people are suffering.
Absolutely.
You get one bad apple in this. Yeah, a couple months ago, Dr. Slesk and I were looking through Joshua, and Joshua 7, I think it is, the sin of Achan, where he takes some of the loot, and everybody's hurting from that. God's mad at all Israel. But
everybody.
Then at the same time, at the end, this is kind of Romans 5, isn't it, where just as sin came through Adam for one, here's this, you know, kind of tie into your previous biblical themes, so the second Adam has this that is going to cover us all.
Exactly.
The righteousness that covers us all. So it's just a beautiful picture of what happens.
It takes us all in, you know, and so that one works pretty well. So those three, I think, hang in there pretty well. They have a sort of a play on that first, second imagery. The others have that type of tension also, but these first three really have that kind of dualism that works together.
Yeah, absolutely. I see that kind of coherence as well come through. So that's a great start. I'm looking at the time here. We should probably take just a very brief break, but we'll pick up with the last four of our seven biblical themes here with Dr. Pavla on the other side of a quick word from our friend Dr. Overdeck.
We'll be back in just a moment to the Concordia Bible Institute podcast. In the meantime, I'd like to have you consider this question. What is most important in higher education? How do you prioritize all the knowledge to be gained at an institution of higher learning? Concordia University, Wisconsin, located on the shores of Lake Michigan in Mequon, Wisconsin, just north of Milwaukee, is an institution that is committed to excellence in learning, but at the same time realizes that excellence in itself is insufficient without development in vocation. We believe that God works through our vocations, our callings, in order to serve the needs of those around us. The mission statement of Concordia University puts it this way: Concordia University, Wisconsin is a Lutheran higher education community committed to helping students develop in mind, body, and spirit for service to Christ in the church and the world. You can learn more about the over 70 programs offered at Concordia by visiting the website www.cuw.edu. And if you're benefiting from our Christ in Every Word podcasts, I encourage you to support this ministry by mentioning it to others and by offering your monetary support. Please consider supporting the Concordia Bible Institute by going to our website, www.concordiabible.org, and clicking on the Contribute page. And now, back to the podcast.
Folks, we are back with our study of the seven biblical themes, special guest podcast here with Dr. Dan Pavla, and not only a colleague, but I got to say, still very much an influence in my life. I was thinking of a story that I could have said earlier, and I'm just going to interject it here real quick, and that is when I was a student here at Concordia, I started as a secondary ed math major.
Right
before sophomore year, my advisor at the time... decided that because of my interest in theology and some of the things that I had expressed, it might be a good idea to just try some of the Greek language and see what I thought. And I always look back at that moment as being a kind of turning point that that changed the whole course of going to pre-sem studies and seminary and the whole thing. So as I've heard you say, hats off to you, Dr. For that guidance back in the day.
So. Well, we're all lucky to have you and all the talents that you bring and teaching ability, administrative ability here with CBI and everything else, and just an outstanding colleague. We're glad. Also young, and we'll be here, we pray, for a very, very long time when the rest of us are done.
Well, so the Lord is good. It's a blessing to be here.
It's a good place.
And also a blessing to hear from you about these seven biblical themes. We've covered the first three in the first half, and I'm seeing here on the list that the fourth one is grace upends your world. So maybe tell us a little bit about what you mean there.
Well, again, it's a farm story. I grew up on a farm where we had to pick rocks every spring. We picked rocks for a week. And if you know farming in the Midwest, I was in Minnesota, the frost heaves these things up. And eventually you have to get even the big ones out. And just picture a big rock, not something you could just pick up by hand, but a two-person crowbar, lever this thing out. And we didn't have a bulldozer or front-end loader to do this. It was us, Dad and I, and we were trying to flip this rock out of a hole onto what's called a stone boat, which is just a flat bed of wood that's towed behind the tractor so that you don't have to lift it. These stones are too big to lift. You're never going to do that. So all you can do is jam the crowbars underneath and lever this thing out. Now take this figuratively. You're promising all kinds of exciting adventures to this rock if it'll just get out of this hole. You're going to show it new sights, introduce it to new friends, give it a new purpose in living, anything. But if you get it up about halfway and it's poised to start this new life and your crowbar slips, it's only going to go one direction, which is right back into the hole. And it just seems to me, I know this is probably the simplest of the biblical narratives, but it's absolutely universal. Give us any opportunity of grace offering us new life, new walk with God, new opportunity, and we will tend to fall back into the hole and cement ourselves into place. We in fact, look at the invitation of grace as a burden and something that is just unwelcome in the extreme. My favorite example is Moses comes and announces to the people of Israel, we're going to be free. We're out of here. Gone. And the consequence, of course, is they have to make bricks without straw. They hate Moses. Now, you would think that the man who's going to announce freedom after 400 years of slavery would be carried on their shoulders, but he is anything but. Grace, the offer of grace, wonderful idea, but it's upended their world and in some ways made it worse. Mary gets the announcement. She's going to be, oh my gosh, the mother of the Messiah. It upends her world because, of course, then when Joseph hears of the coming birth, divorce, abandonment, everything that is the worst in her imagination. So oftentimes we find that a biblical narrative in our personal life is this opportunity, this gift of God comes initially with a very challenging beginning. I have a verse I use many times, Psalm 30, verse 5. Weeping endures for a night, but joy comes in the morning. Mm-hmm. And to hold on through that night with the expectation of joy, with the promise that it's grace, not retribution, but grace that has upended your world,
yeah.
That's a challenge.
That's an amazing thing. I've often thought of this one when I teach Abraham in Genesis 12, where the first thing he's there might be some special promises there, but the first thing he's told is, get on up and go. Leave your family, friends, everything you know, because I've got some great blessings in store, and through you all the families of the earth will be blessed and things like that. But boy, what was that first night like?
I know, exactly.
I kind of like it here.
Right. And is anything bad going to happen here? No.
Yeah.
No, it's not a Noah. Yeah. Better build an ark because the flood's coming. Now, that makes sense.
Yeah, that's right.
But
that's right.
Leave.
Right.
Because nothing bad's going to happen here, but I'm going to leave anyway. Okay.
You know, in some ways, that kind of resembles what your next biblical theme is here, this sort of... you know, grace upending the world. It is not always going to feel like greatness, let's say, initially, and yet it is in the end. And that ties in, I think, with this fifth biblical theme, and that is greatness ought to look like greatness.
Well,
that makes sense to me, but go ahead and unpack that for us.
Well, Bruce Catton is a wonderful historian, or was. He's passed now. He wrote a trilogy of the history of Ulysses S. Grant. And that line is a quote from the first paragraph in the book Grant Moves South, the first of the trilogy. And Catton describes Grant as a man who looks like nothing special. He would go about camp, army camp. Of course, is a Civil War general who in the end was a four-star general and the one who saves the Union, Union forces. But he was described by Catton as going about in a mud-splattered private's coat, no insignia on him whatsoever, and Catton said that this in the end surprised people because they assumed that greatness ought to look like greatness.
Sure.
But Grant could never look like anything at all, and that was the shock. Mm-hmm. And so I love this one, and my experience is that students make, in many ways, the most of this of all the themes, is that does God act on the principle of greatness ought to look like greatness?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it a hidden greatness? And I think it's a wonderful both and. And Christmas Eve is my favorite example. The birth of Jesus, does it come in a way that says greatness looks like greatness? Well, when you pull back the curtain of heaven and all the angel chorus sings, I'm thinking that's greatness
that's
looking like greatness.
Yeah,
and yet the announcement comes with, and this will be a sign for you, you'll find a baby wrapped in swaddling clothes lying in a manger.
Yeah.
And that's a strange greatness to find him in the stable, in the manger.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seems to me throughout the ministry of Jesus, his, you know, in dogmatic terms, his humiliation and his exaltation are the both and of this biblical theme. It just puts it in a smaller phrase. His miracles, many of them are done in a hidden greatness. He changes water into wine, and no one except the servants who drew the water knew what was really going on. The steward didn't know. The couple didn't know. It's a hidden greatness.
Mm-hmm.
But Transfiguration, I think greatness is looking like greatness
absolutely.
There.
Absolutely.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So it's up to God, and I think by our nature, our prayers will always request a greatness that looks like greatness, ties to my immediacy of instant perfection. Instant perfection, the first theme, looks for, in terms of time, a greatness. And this one says, and that greatness ought to be something I see and I easily identify as that's God at work.
It reminds me a lot of some of the stories, again, in the Old Testament, where God kind of chooses the weaker or the lesser, the stranger, the sort of, Gideon's a little guy, and he's going to do some great things through this?
Exactly.
Well, absolutely, and the weaker, the lesser, it kind of ties into some of those other, you know, not the first, second, and the kind of perfection that comes at the end of the day, the greatness that maybe doesn't look at that great to us initially, but yet at the end, you know, it is pretty great. In fact, it's perfect.
It's strange greatness. Yeah.
All right. Well, that brings us to the sixth biblical theme here. Two more left here in the last little chunk of time here. Then that is God curing with the illness itself. Now, speaking of strange things,
God curing with the illness itself. Well,
what do you think?
Well, it really does tie to that one, that if God uses the small and the hidden, but those are relatively neutral. You see, the theme we just did, that greatness ought to look like greatness, or it's a hidden greatness, but that's a neutral quality. Now we're going to push it to the extreme, and God says it's the illness itself that I'm going to use, not just a placebo or something in the middle. And that's completely opposite to us, because we seek the opposite in terms of our problems or our illness. And I mean, this is just really easy. Every mother knows if your child is hungry, you feed him. If he's tired, you put him to sleep. If he's cold, you give him a coat, da-da-da. Makes perfect sense. We see illness, we go the other way. We see death, we go the other way. Mm-hmm. And God says, I'm going to cure with the illness itself. The best example, obviously, Moses and the bronze serpent. Mm-hmm. The people are bit by the serpents, and God's remedy is to have Moses make a bronze serpent, put it up, and everyone who looks on the serpent will live. I'm sure if I was bitten by a poisonous snake and dying from it, a snake is the last thing I want to see. Mongoose, sounds good, but snake, no way. Yeah. And yet, doesn't this, I mean, what I love about this, it's such a triumph over evil. You know, snatch that snake up, so to speak. I know it's a bronze snake, but snatch up a snake, so to speak, and say, you came to kill, tie him onto a pole, and say, now you're going to bring life to the very ones you came to kill. And so I think there's more power and more creativity in the action of God than simply fleeing evil by snatching evil up, turning. I love the imagery of twisting evil around the pole until it results in the very opposite for which it came.
Yeah,
there you go. And so in the likeness of sinful flesh, he has destroyed sin. And by the accepting of a body of death, he's delivered us from our fear of death for all time.
It reminds me of that passage in Hebrews, through death he destroyed death.
Exactly.
And it's just a fascinating way. And speaking of the bronze serpent, when Jesus said, I'll be lifted up, you know, so also the Son of Man will be lifted up like that bronze serpent. You look at that serpent and you see the kind of thing that caused the pain, or you see your own sin, so to speak. But at the same time, you also see what saves you from your sin, that very instrument that God is using as well. So
the lifted up cross.
It's a beautiful theme, really, curing with the illness itself. So, all right, well, that leaves us just one more here in our final few minutes that we have with Dr. Dan Pavlo with seven biblical themes. The last one, last but not least, perfection welcomes failure.
Yeah, not usually in our world. I'll tell you what, I introduce it. It depends on who you're with, but when I'm with the nurses, young nurses about ready to go on the nursing floor for the first time, I say, imagine in the first week or two, you're on the floor serving, and you've got a nurse who's been on that floor for 40 years. She rules that floor. You screw up bad, just really bad. Is your first thought to run to her and tell her, guess what I did? I mean, no way. No. Well, perfection repels failure. That's our usual experience. If I screw up badly, I do not go out and find the perfect example and say, you know what I did? I really screwed up. We run the other way. And yet, here's the strangest thing, is that in Hebrews 4, we have in God a perfection that invites failure to come. We do not have a high priest who's unable to sympathize with us in our weakness, but one who has been tempted in all things, even as we are, yet without sin. Let us draw near, therefore, that we might find grace to help in time of need. Mm-hmm. You know, we have a tested God who is absolutely perfect in every place that we have failed in, and the outcome of that is not that he repels us with a, look what you people did, or that he sits on a daunting height that none of us can achieve. Well, you can come, but you're going to have to match every footstep that I've laid out, which we can't, but his perfection is poised as welcome. Utter failures attracted to ultimate perfection. And that this one is so strange because it's just not our nature. You know, perfection doesn't welcome and attract utter failure to stand, sit, be near it.
Yeah.
We don't. But God does.
It's exactly, what he does all the time, isn't it?
It does.
Even with some of the narratives about Jesus going right for sinners and tax collectors.
They drew to him, not in a, hey, buddy, we know that you're as fallen as we are. No.
Yeah.
They recognized him. Thief on the cross is a perfect example. He knows that he is utterly wretched and that Jesus has done, in his own words, nothing wrong. Remember me when you come into your kingdom. I mean, that man was drawn to the coming kingdom and Christ in this very tension-filled, utter failure is drawn to utter perfection.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's a fun one.
That's a fun one indeed, and I'm looking at the clock here, and we were right on the time here for our standard podcast slot, but Dr. Dan Pavel with us today again on these seven biblical themes. Dr. Pavel, thanks so much for your insights today. It's a pleasure to have you with me here in the podcast room.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you for letting me come.
That is, as I said, all the time we have for this session of Christ in Every Word. But as always, please consider mentioning this podcast to your family and friends so that they can learn more about God's Word with us. The mission of the Concordia Bible Institute is to provide Christ-centered Bible instruction from distinguished experts like Dr. Dan Pavel here, who teach Christ in every word of the Old and New Testaments to strengthen faith and spread belief in the one true God. Again, if you benefit from this podcast series, I encourage you to consider supporting the Bible Institute by going to our website, www.concordiabible.org, and clicking on our contribute page. Until next time, I'm Dr. Brian Gurman, here today with Dr. Dan Pavla, wishing you God's blessings in Christ Jesus our Lord.